Okay, well, thank you. So I'm Alan Carlson. I don't work on the types of things that have been discussed so far. So this talk's going to be quite different than things we've heard before about either network interactions or statistics or landscapes, although I used to do some work on landscapes. So I came because it's supposed to be a meeting on viruses and viral evolution. So from what I can tell, no one has discussed viruses yet. So let me give you an introduction to HIV. It's a virus I've been studying for about the last 15 years. And what my plan is to spend the first maybe 20 minutes telling you about very old work, a little bit about the virus, how it works, how it interacts with cells within the body, and models that we've developed really over the last 15 years, and then move to current work and tell you about some stuff, and even sequence data that's coming out, and some evolutionary questions that'll be closer to what you like. So I'm assuming that most people here do not know very much about HIV, and if I'm wrong, tell me, I'll just speed up. So human immunodeficiency virus it's an enveloped virus, spherical particles, they're about 90 nanometers in size. They interact with cells mostly in the immune system, like T lymphocytes or T cells, which are about 8 to 10 micron in diameter. When they're healthy, they're spherical looking cells. And then an interaction, which I'll show you a little bit more in the next slide, involves proteins on the surface of the virus interacting with proteins on the surface of the cell. And the predominant one is some cell surface protein called the CD4 molecule. So the virus, as I said, is an enveloped virus, so it has a lipid bilayer, and it has decorated on its surface a protein called the envelope protein, or GP120, and a stalk part of it, which is called GP41. This is from Scientific American a long time ago. It's out of date. Current estimates probably are more like 8 to 10 stalks, not quite as many. But this envelope protein, the GP120 here, interacts with CD4 on the surface of a T cell. That interaction causes a conformational change in this molecule. It opens up another binding site, and that protein then interacts with a second receptor on a cell. The predominant one is something called CCR5. So it takes two interactions. That then leads to the fusion of a second conformational change that brings this membrane in close contact with the membrane of the cell. There's a fusion peptide that's exposed, the two membranes fuse, and this interior of the virus is brought into the host cell that's being infected. The virus encodes two RNA molecules, so its genome is RNA. It also carries with it some HIV-encoded enzymes, which here are just depicted by these black dots. The predominant one is something called reverse transcriptase, which is an enzyme that will copy the RNA into a DNA copy. That DNA copy then is moved into the nucleus of the cell, and another enzyme that it's carrying called integrase is involved in splicing the cDNA copy into the genome of the infected cell. That's sort of how all retroviruses work. That cDNA, it's called a provirus when it's integrated into the chromosome, and that will then ultimately get expressed and lead to generation of messenger RNAs, which will be the form of viral RNAs again, plus the various proteins. Yes?
Wait, there's an enzyme responsible for the transport mechanism?
No, that it uses host enzymes for.
So the
it only encodes...
inserts it into the
DNA. Yes. The other thing that's interesting, and this picture doesn't quite depict properly, is interesting when reverse transcription occurs. The reverse transcriptase enzyme seems to interact simultaneously with both RNAs, and when it copies, it hops back and forth. So it doesn't just make a copy off of one of these strands, and it seems to hop back and forth anywhere between 3 and 10 times in various cell culture systems. So recombination between these two strands is extraordinarily prevalent. In fact, it does recombine to make it. Now, in most circumstances, these copies would be identical. However, some cells can be multiply infected, so multiple genomes could have gotten integrated into a cell on occasion. And that means that an infected cell will be making RNAs off of two different templates, and there seems to be some probability that a virus will then encapsulate two different RNAs. And if a cell is now infected with a virus that has encapsulated two different RNAs, then during reverse transcription, it will generate true recombinants. And I'll show you some data on recombination.
What's the symmetric group of the capsid?
Don't know. So it's an envelope protein, so it's not, it doesn't need a structure from the capsid itself, but I don't know what the structural group is. This is a cartoon of what the dynamics of infection look like. It's ancient, from 1996. But the general idea is that when you're infected, which is the virus, which here its dynamics are shown in red, and it's on a log scale, that there's a period of time where you can't detect any virus. Then it tends to grow exponentially, reaches a peak, comes down. In a very short period of time, which is called the acute infection, and I'll tell you a lot about that at the latter part of the talk if we get there. And then you'll see the time scale here is broken from weeks to years, and then over a very long period of time, the viral levels stay relatively stable within a person. If one looks at this scale here from this cartoon, it's going from about 5 times 10 to the third to 10 to the fourth over close to eight years. And that's, as an average, isn't bad. If you look at people over time scales of weeks, days, and months, you can't detect any change in this viral level, which is called the viral load. And it reaches what the virologists call as a set point. And that can be very variable among people, but this general pattern is reflected in most people. Also, simultaneous with the virus hardly changing over these long periods, there's a very slow decline in the number of cells that the virus is infecting, the helper T cells or CD4 positive T cells. And that's being depicted here in blue. A healthy individual has roughly 1,000 of these cells per microliter of blood. That declines, and when the CD4 count clinically gets to sort of the order of 200, your immune system doesn't function as well anymore, and you start coming up with symptoms of many other diseases. And what kills you in HIV infection is opportunistic infections, infections from something other than HIV. Yes, sir?
It's very interesting, I think. You said that in any one individual, it's true that it's pretty much flat over these years. But the level at which it's flat may be very different.
Yes, that's right. Orders of magnitude different. So there are some people who walk around with levels of 100,000 or a few 100,000. And then there are people who walk around down here at almost undetectable.
What about their T cell level? So they're immune.
Again, this is, T cell levels bounce around a lot more than shown here. People who have high set points, sit up here, on average, the T cell decay is faster. So there's a correlation between the set point viral level and how long it takes you to progress to AIDS, which means how long it takes to get below T cell counts below 200.
Is the set point viral level have any correlation with gene strain or sequence structure of the AIDS virus?
A little bit, yes. Yes. So there are genetic correlates that have been found. So, So let me just leave it at that. So clearly there's something going on, and there have been some large some screens to try and understand that to some extent. But the properties of the virus obviously to some extent determine its pathogenicity, and also properties of the host. So it correlates also with certain genetic characteristics of people that are infected. Just in case you're interested, so this is the latest data in the U.S. that I got from the CDC. In fact, last week they just posted it, going out to 2007. This is the number of deaths per year by HIV early in the epidemic. As you can see, it was monotonically increasing until around 1995, which is when this combination therapy was introduced, and that led to substantial decline in deaths. And unfortunately, it has stabilized. So the number of people dying of AIDS in the United States has remained relatively constant since 1999, and that's because there's constant reinfection going on in the population. So yellow is the number of people who are being diagnosed every year. And again, early, once we had this combination therapy, there were less people being infected, less people were infectious, and there was great progress being made. But right now, risky sex is back. People aren't very worried about HIV. And so the number of new infections per year has not gone down. And this is the prevalence in the United States. So because people are living longer, there are constantly more and more people in the population who are HIV positive. So it's still a huge problem.
How is the data about the non-treated individuals? What is that data now?
Non-traditional, sorry.
Over so many years?
There's various screenings being done, so it's a reportable disease, so physicians do
But then they don't treat it.
Well, now most people are getting treated, yes. That's why they're living longer with it. So in the United States, I'm sure 90-some-odd percent of people are treated. There are some people who refuse treatment.
And so this graph would make one afraid that it's everything else stays constant, that the number of new infections would go up again.
Right. So in some places they are. I know, for example, in San Francisco, numbers of new infections have been going up. And I was actually surprised that it's not reflected in here, because there's other data that I've seen showing it's going up slightly.
But maybe also the transmission is lower if people are being treated.
Yes, it is. It is definitely.
Yes.
So when people are treated, their quote set point viral load goes way down, and their probability of transmitting goes way down. Okay. So let me show you now some experiments that I've been involved in, where we trying to understand the time scales involved, what's actually going on in infection within a given person. So this is old work, but it'll set the stage for some things, and I presume you haven't heard about this. So we're going to look at people who are sitting here with their set point viral load, and we're going to perturb that set point with drugs. So we're going to treat them now with antiretroviral drugs. It's going to interfere with virus replication within that individual and cause a perturbation of this. And the idea is to try and infer the dynamics of the infection within a given person. This old data was very misleading in the sense that if one took people and studied them over long periods of time, what you saw is that the viral levels weren't changing. So people would be sampled every 6 months, typically early in this infection. And what you found is the amount of virus wasn't changing. And so the early impression in this epidemic was that this was a very slow infection. So things were very slow within given individuals, and it wasn't so clear when to treat them because their viral levels weren't changing very much, nor how aggressively to treat them. Drug resistance is and was a problem. So let me just show you data from really one of the earliest clinical trials of a really potent drug that are called protease inhibitors. And they're the sort of one of the backbones of current drugs. So these are three individual patients who were at various set points. So this is somebody at 100,000 copies. Eric was asking me about different set points, and all of them were fairly high levels. Time zero is here, so this is just showing you, at least over this 10-day period, the virus wasn't changing. And we have data sets. This was a placebo-controlled trial, so there's some people who have data for a whole month, and they just stay somewhat flat. You give them this drug, and as you can see, you get this decline in virus between 10 and 100-fold over the course of about 2 weeks, and then something happens. Here's another individual, a little bit noisier before treatment. Same pattern, the third one, same pattern. And what I can tell you that we now know is that this virus in most people comes back up because of drug resistance. So that virus was isolated and sequenced. So the half-life of this decline over a large number of patients who were studied in this particular trial was about 2 days. So before this, we were thinking of things going on timescales of years. What it tells us is that if one interferes with virus replication with a drug, that the body of an infected person, and these people have been infected for years, is still capable of eliminating virus on a timescale of days. So we know that one's capable of clearing this virus very, very rapidly. It also tells us that at set point, that virus has to be produced very, very rapidly. So if you're naturally clearing this, let's assume, and we now know this is true, the drugs don't affect how rapidly you clear the virus. They don't act on the host in that regard. So it's saying that people during their natural infection are clearing virus, estimated here is every 2 days. That means the virus naturally is doubling every 2 days. And because of that balance between clearance and production, you're staying at this set point. So,
how quickly do the T cell levels go up?
When you bring this down, the T cells do come back up, and one can, over this time period, they'll go up quite substantially in terms of percentage. The actual numbers are not that dramatic. They go up about, the count goes up about 50 to 75 during the first month of therapy, cells per microliter. But their slope is quite high.
And I mean, crucial to this implication is that you know this drug is not like actively killing viruses, right?
Correct. And the reason we know that is this has been repeated now with lots of different classes of drugs. And so at the time, it wasn't so clear if there was a particular drug effect or not.
So does the half-life depend on T cell count?
As far as we can tell, no. It's not very dependent upon that. But I won't be definitive because it's a little tricky when you start putting a lot of studies together from different sources. Sometimes you start seeing a little bit of a correlation. So let me tell you that, yes?
What happened in the, when it starts to grow again?
Yes.
It returns to the same level or
yes.
Increases?
No, so this will go back up. This will go back up to the same level. It goes exactly back up to where it was before. That's the extent of the assays under resistance. So let me show you a cartoon picture, which already will tell us that we can get more information out of that experiment. So, and this type of cartoon picture has been used now for very many types of viruses, and it's a starting point. It really is a toy model. So the idea is that you have free viruses, virions. They interact with cells susceptible to infection, which happen to be T cells, but in general in this field are called target cells, the targets of the virus. That interaction leads to the generation of infected cells, and in the equations I'll show you, it has an infection rate constant K. More modern theory has picked up a parameter, now calls this beta, which has been used historically in epidemiology for infection rates. In HIV, I won't go through it with you today, but there's many different cell populations get infected, and the easiest way to keep track of them in the models would be a star on them. So stars just mean infected. In other viruses, when I talk later, we'll just use I for infected cells if there's only one population. So these are infected cells. They're called productively infected because these cells produce no virus. There are states of infection where you won't produce virus, so as in the case of bacteriophages, they can be equivalent of lysogenic. So these cells then produce new virus. I showed you that if we interfere somehow with this process, virus can be cleared. We also know that one of the hallmarks is depletion of T cells. So clearly infected cells are going to be dying. Uninfected cells also die, but the time scale in a healthy individual, at least for T cells to turn over, is of order months. So that experiment I showed you was data over 2 weeks or so. So this is not a terribly important part. So if you start with somebody at steady state in terms of the viral levels at the set point, that means these productively infected cells are making virus as fast as it's being cleared. And if you come in with a drug that interferes with the infection process, the easiest way to think about it is turning off this rate of infection. then this cartoon tells us, before we do any analysis, that the first order, if you're at steady state before you give the drug, you shouldn't see anything happen. Because the infected cells are still there, they're producing virus, body's still clearing it. And yet I showed you the data shows you get this very fast decline. So what that tells us, if you think about it, is that the infected cells must be turning over very, very rapidly. So the reason the virus declines in those experiments when you interfere with the infection process is that these cells must be disappearing, so the source has to disappear. So if you do some simple theory, it's going to tell us from that type of experiment not only how fast virus is being cleared, but we can get the estimates now of how fast cells are being cleared. So before we started this work, there was absolutely nothing known about the dynamics of infection within in vivo in humans as opposed to in a petri dish. So using really simple models with law of mass action for infection, with a virus interacting with target cells, causing infected cells dying, at some rate delta, every time they're over their lifespan or when they die, they release N virus particles, which is called the burst size, or N times delta is sometimes called the viral production rate, P. Virus is cleared. It's used by a linear process because I showed you the data. It fit very well to an exponential decay. We'll analyze this in lots of different approximations. The simplest one is, in fact, over short periods, just to hold the target cells constant because it takes 10 years for depletion. So if I do an experiment over 7 days or 14 days, they're not going to change dramatically. This becomes a linear system, and one can study the effects of perturbation to see whether or not this toy model agrees with data. So here's an example. I'm not going to write an equation for the uninfected cells. I'll just hold them at their initial value when I start therapy. And your two major classes of drugs, one of them is called a reverse transcriptase inhibitor, an RT inhibitor. That prevents the incoming virus from reverse transcribing its genome, and really basically blocks the ability to generate an infected cell. You can't make a DNA copy. So that's being represented here by this parameter epsilon, which we call the effectiveness of the RT inhibitor. If it's 100% effective, this is 1, so you get no new productively infected cells. The way protease inhibitors work, and I don't really want to go through this in great detail, is but within cells that are already infected, if you block the action of this HIV-encoded enzyme protease, cells still make viral particles that contain RNA, but they're not infectious. So they create virus, which we call V sub NI, non-infectious particles. So if you have 100% effective protease inhibitor, you make no new infectious particles, but you only make non-infectious particles. And these then look very much like the RT inhibitors, that you can't get a new infection, but it's sort of delayed by one generation. So you now still make some virus for a while, but that virus doesn't infect. So being a theorist to try and get some idea of what's going on, so we hold T constant. We knew these drugs were effective. You saw the viral loads decayed. We don't know exactly what these numbers were, so we just assume the drugs are 100% effective. It's not true, but it gives you a limit that you can start getting a handle on things. So if you make these two assumptions, that you're in steady state, that the number of target cells doesn't change, and the drugs are 100% effective, I'll show you some data right now with protease inhibitors, but you can solve this system of ODEs. It's trivial, it's just a linear system. There are two eigenvalues, C and delta, the two things you'd like to know. C is how fast virus is being cleared, that rate constant, and delta is the rate at which infected cells are dying, neither of which was known in vivo. And eigenvalue C is duplicated, so, pardon me?
Why you assume T is constant?
Since over a short, the experimental data that we'll look at is collected over 2 weeks, T goes down over, takes 8 years on that cartoon, for example, to go down from 1,000 to 200. So over a course of weeks or months, on average, you can't measure any detectable change in T cell levels.
When you don't treat.
Right, so they will go up a little bit. And we can correct for that, and we have corrected for that. But simplest, let me just give you the zeroth order. Then what you do is you can go back and you can look at the solutions to nonlinear equations where T is changing. In fact, the way we did it is we actually used empirical data for each patient that we analyzed, measured exactly how the T cells changed, fit that to, you know, do a spline fit to get some idea of the dynamics, and put in a time-dependent team, and then do the whole thing numerically. And it changes things by about 5%.
But is the key that the actual fraction of the T cell population that is infected at any point in time is relatively small, so that even when you mess around with how much virus there is?
The key is really that the drugs drop the virus, so that infection term where the T's come in becomes not very important under therapy. So it's like the viral levels are going down. Don't get hung up on that. This is just to do the mathematics in a very simple way to get some ideas.
I want to understand the experiment. Is it the total T cell or is it the uninfected T cells?
Uninfected. Why does that look?
Hold it constant. You can tell is it in the experiment.
Yes, it's the uninfected ones, that quote the target cells for the infection. This just gives you some insight. But anyway, if you take that solution to the linear ODE with all these approximations and fit it to the data. See. So these are actual measurements of HIV RNA done by PCR type measurements in two individuals who are being treated. You can do nonlinear regression to it and estimate these two parameters, C and delta. So we've got the first indication of how rapidly virus is being cleared and how long the infected cells live. Boris?
Sorry to come back to this T cell number dependence. You're saying it's not very important, but doesn't the rate of amplification of the virus directly depend on T cell?
On the infected T cells, yes.
But
so in the infected T cells, what this tells us is infected T cells live for so the infected T cells live for about a day. And so the virus is dependent upon those cells. And yet, and to maintain that steady state for any individual patient, yes, it does require a constant supply of new T cells.
Well, I guess I'd be very much reassured if this fit did not involve T cell level as sort of a free parameter.
Ah. Okay. No, it's not a free parameter. That fit is to this equation where T cells don't show up at all. So it's not a parameter. What you can then do, as I said, is you go back to the full model, to this one, where you still put in these epsilons, and you can now solve this numerically and get the viral levels with T changing. And the way we did it is instead of solving this equation, because this is not right, the fact of a linear supply and a constant supply and linear death. It's just something a theorist like to play with because you can solve the equations. Okay. So we actually did you can actually fit the T cell increases in each patient over the period of therapy. And they are, you get an increasing function. You make this an empirical function, T of T, based on a fit. And then you solve all of this and do parameter estimation. And it turns out you get something like a 5-10% change in the estimates of parameters. The other thing you can do is you back off the fact that the effectiveness is 100%. And what we learned by doing both of those things is the parameter estimates that we got for C and delta were minimal estimates. So in fact, if the drug effectiveness is not as effective, it's not 100% effective, there's still more viral production going on. Means to fit the data, you have to clear a virus faster, kill infected cells. Same thing, if more T cells come up, there's more infection, that means you've got to clear things even faster. So it goes in one direction, and they're minimal estimates. We now know by doing the same type of experiment with much better drugs that get closer to 100% effective, that the lifetime of these productively infected cells is closer to a day. That experiment, if you actually looked at the data fits, only gave us a half-life of free virus of about less than 6 hours. This is totally different experiments now that we've now learned that the free virus turns over with a half-life probably somewhere between a half hour and an hour. So it's very fast clearance that this type of drug perturbation experiment couldn't pick up. But what's important, once we got the lifespan of these productively infected cells and something about how fast virus was turning over, It allowed us to make an estimate of how much virus replication was going on to maintain the set point. So you measure in the patient how much virus there is, 100,000 copies per ml, multiplied by the number of mLs of fluid. And then you multiply that by these clearance rates. That tells you how fast, how total number of virus particles being cleared to maintain steady state. Numbers like this have to be produced per day. You can also figure out how many T cells are being infected. And it's probably 10 to the 7th to 10 to the 8th are infected at any given time in a human. What was interesting in this is every time a cell is infected, reverse transcription can occur. Errors are made. Reverse transcriptase is an error-prone enzyme because it's copying RNA to DNA. The error rates in vivo for point substitutions are about 2 times 10 to the minus 5th per base copied. And so one can make a calculation now, assuming, say, 10 to the 8th infected cells, 10 to the 8th cells are being infected every day, and that's because these cells only live one day. So to maintain a steady state again, you have to continually infect cells. So this is assuming 10 to the 8th cells are infected every day. From a binomial, you can compute the error rates, what fraction of cells you expect to have their genomes copied or have one error, two errors, or three errors. And you can compare that to the possible number of variants. The genome is about 10,000 bases. So you take one base and it can be miscopied into any of the other three. So there's only 30,000 single point mutations or 4.5 number pairs, et cetera. And what this told us is that every single point mutation was being visited about 1,000 times per day in a typical infected patient. So that says you can expect to find if any viable virus that has all possible point mutations sitting in it from any infected one. And the number of pairwise changes were about a little less than 1% of all possible changes. So again, in a typical patient or large population of patients, you'd expect to find enough variation that if one were to use a drug in which it requires one or two mutations to generate drug resistance, that that's going to pre-exist in the vast majority of patients or a large number of patients. And it's only if you go to drug combinations where you require three or more variations that you're going to start finding that the population of viruses in these patients is not going to explode. This was the motivation behind combination therapy that was started after this type of analysis was done. So that's why three drugs. The idea is that each drug at the time was pretty much susceptible to a single drug. A single mutation.
So these mutations are really the main source of diversity.
Yes.
Evolutions, and recombination can effectively be ignored.
In terms of drug resistance, yes. In terms of the evolution of the virus, there's clearly recombination, but it generates new subtypes, but so they're both sitting there. Anyway, that generated combination therapy. My experimental colleague in doing all of this, David Ho, was very instrumental in popularizing this and getting the community to adopt it, and that's why the number of deaths started going down after 1995 as people started introducing combination therapy. And I don't want to dwell on this too much, but if you then do the same experiment now but with combination therapy, so you avoid drug resistance, before I showed you or I told you that after about 2 weeks we started seeing the virus coming back up again, which is why we stopped that analysis. Well, if you do combination therapy, what you now see is these nice, we call two-phase declines. That's again, these are semi-log plots, this is on a log scale. So it's saying there's really two exponential phases, which you can analyze. The first phase, which is this early one, just before I told you, had a half-life of about 2 days. You can see it's slightly reduced now because the drugs are better, blocking more of the infection. But then there's this slower second phase, which is highly variable, as you can see here, between having a half-life between 7 days and 2 weeks. And that's been reproduced now in huge numbers of patients. And other work went on to try and understand the biology of why you have two phases. And I should say, with better assays that we can use now, if you continue to follow this down, what happens is you find it goes into a third phase, which is even slower than this, with half-lives and approaching things that look like six-month half-lives. And then ultimately, it looks like it goes to a very low steady state in most patients, with assays now that can go down to measuring about one copy of RNA per ml of fluid. And so the vast majority of patients sort of get hung up at a few copies of RNA per ml for years, so maybe four phases. As I said, this is all pretty old work. And if one were very interested in the biology, I could tell you about large numbers of models involving things, but the bottom line in terms of our understanding is we think some of this has to do with different cell populations that are being infected that turn over at different rates. So I told you that the productively infected cells have a half-life of a day or something. Well, it turns out that they don't produce all the virus. They may produce 93-97%, at least some of the analysis that we did. If you come in with drugs that prevent new infections, well, these cell populations die out. And now what happens is it uncovers other populations that are producing virus and much less virus, maybe 1% or a few percent of the virus, but they live a lot longer. And so there's been called long-lived infected cell populations or cells like macrophages and monocytes that at least in cell culture can live a month or more and continuously produce virus. There are other states of T cells, rest cells that are close to rest rather than activated that produce virus at lower levels.
What kills the infected cells? Is it the virus?
Yes.
Or the virus?
Well, the virus does, and also the immune system can, but the virus itself is what we call cytopathic.
It would be mostly the virus determining this, the virus and the cell itself,
yes,
determining these cell,
yes,
types.
Although, so in vitro, in a cell coat and put it in a dish, the virus will directly kill these cells. So we know it can. The other thing that's interesting for those of us who play in physical chemistry, let me just say that because I show you this picture, there are cells that capture foreign particles in our lymph nodes. Lymph nodes act, quote, as filters in our spleen. So there's a population of cells immunologists call follicular dendritic cells. And they will capture virus antibody complexes, quote, immune complexes, antigen antibody complexes. That's what these red dots are. And if one takes a biopsy from somebody's tonsils, say somebody who's infected, or a lymph node, but biopsies have been from tonsils would be much easier, and looks at these cells under a microscope and studies them, what you find is they're just loaded with these viruses. And in fact, the estimate is that about 10 to the 11th virus particle sits on the surface of these cells in a typical infected person. If you treat them so that the viral pools in the blood go down, the level of virus on these cells goes down, so the attachment is reversible, even though each virus is probably bound here by anywhere between one and maybe 40 or 50 different chemical bonds, if you look at the molecular interactions going on. So they're reversible interactions, but they're highly multivalent, and so there's some interesting things that one can do about studying this as another source for these low levels of viremia. Remember I told you, no matter when you treat people for a long period of time, we never get down to zero as far as we can tell. So this is one. There's other ones in terms of cells that we call latently infected, the equivalent of what? Being in lysogeny, which aren't producing virus, that then can be woken up and start producing virus. They transcribe the viral genome, and that's been another, that's probably the major barrier right now for eradication. Yes?
The reason why you, why I understand it is that the motivation for using three drugs is that
drug resistance.
Is that drug resistance, but it assumes that for any single drug, you can evolve resistance with just one.
Right, so that's no longer true. So we're now, there are now fourth generation drugs that require three and four mutations to get around a single drug. So, but in the mid-1990s, when this was started, pretty much one mutation would allow one to get off. That's no longer true. But they're still trying. I was just reading yesterday, one of these email alerts on things. There's a trial going on in Thailand now where they're comparing five drugs to three drugs. So there's still resistance problems in the real world. Resistant virus circulates to many of these classes of drugs. Many patients fail, mainly because many of them, because they're not compliant. They just go on and off their drugs, and they do this lovely selection process, and then they transmit to other people. So a few years ago, at least in San Francisco, when it was being monitored, something like 20% of new infections was with drug-resistant virus to the major classes being used there.
So if I understand correctly, there is also this issue with the alternative mode of transmission, so direct contact.
It's mostly
transmission between T cells. So does it also make them resistant to protease altogether?
Oh, you mean the transmission of the virus?
Yeah.
So the virus, can, right, it can go directly from cell to cell.
Well, that's not clear, with your half an hour rate.
No, I don't know. It depends on what the transmission is. So if it's a piece of viral RNA that goes from one cell to another, then these protease inhibitors won't work.
I've seen movies of this thing in a dish, and it's actually striking. So these infected cells get crazy. They make lots of sort of synaptic kind of processes, and they're very agitated. They stick to each other, and then you see the neighboring cell light up with killing the whole
virus. Right. So if it's the virus that goes across as a virion, coming off of one cell, then the protease inhibitors will still work. So the way protease inhibitors work, and let me just do this quickly because I want to get on to the next part, which has to do with sequences and evolution. The viral genome is very compact, as in many viruses, and the way it transcribes the genetic information is it makes what's called a polyprotein. So instead of having start and stops for each of the individual enzymes, the genome just encodes one long protein, mostly. And that protein, then, polyprotein, has reverse transcriptase, it has integrase, it has some of the matrix proteins, it has protease. And so this protease has to autocatalytically cleave itself and other sites to make functional proteins. If it doesn't, what happens is you just get a virus particle, still has its RNA in it, and it's got this huge polyprotein. It infects a new cell, and that polyprotein is not cleaved, so it doesn't have reverse transcriptase, doesn't have integrase, and, quote, it's not infectious. And also the particles even look strange morphologically because the matrix proteins aren't proper. So that's the protease business. So I don't want to dwell on this, but just tell you that. So where are we now? So that was, I just told you things about over 10 years old. Well, what we would like to do is stop this infection by coming up with a vaccine. And we'd like to know something about what the immune system is doing and what goes on in the early events. So one unique thing about HIV infection is there are no documented cases of anyone who's had confirmed infection, which means you can detect the amount of virus in them, who has self-eliminated the virus, who's been cured, spontaneously cleared the virus. Every other illness that we know, there's some fraction of the population that survives and clears a virus. Maybe 10%, 20%, 80%, but people do spontaneously get cured. HIV is, as far as we know, no one has ever spontaneously cured themselves. So there's a fundamental question of whether or not the immune system, even if we try and boost it, whether or not it will actually be able to eliminate this virus. And our attempts to build a vaccine, of course, are heavily dependent upon that. Secondly, we'd like to know something about the viruses that infect. As I said, the viruses diversify by this point mutation or combination. So a person who's been infected for many years has a huge quasi-species, huge diversity of viruses. Are all of those transmitted? Are the ones that are sort of selected for transmission, do they have special properties? So maybe we only have to protect against a subpopulation of viruses.
Sure. I don't understand how one can assert that no one has cleared.
So there's no patient.
So suppose the clearance occurs in the first 3 days of an acute infection.
Right.
And so these people just don't come to see the doctor, right?
That's very possible. If I had time today, I'll tell you about that because we're very interested in that. And I think that probably occurs. But I said no one who has documented infection. That means that their level of viremia is high enough to detect in blood. So I think that there are, I personally think, and that occurs, that people have very, very low levels of virus and that they do eliminate it. And physicians just don't call them infected. And I think since I probably won't get to this, but what we know, which is very interesting, from epidemiological studies, that if you look at couples, which we call discordant, one partner is HIV infected, maybe on drugs, maybe not, the other partner who is not infected. And you can ask at what frequency, over large studies, does the other partner become infected? About 10 such studies now have been published. And if you look only at the cases where people aren't on therapy, so natural infection. Even in such circumstances, the rate of transmission from the uninfected to the infected, from the infected to the uninfected partner in normal sex is about 1 in 1,000 sex acts. For rough sex, for men who have men with men, that number might get down to 1 in 100 on average. So we know that there are a lot of examples where introduction of the virus doesn't do anything. Also, I won't have time, I'm sure, with this audience, but I can show you later. We have experiments in monkeys where you use a model virus, SIV, where you just inoculate the virus intravaginally or indirectly and ask, does it infect? Because you can know. And again, there's an enormous number of cases. It's dose-dependent, but you can clearly document that you can't see anything, no noticeable infection. Whether or not one virus gets in, we can't tell because you can't find it. But at least if you observe these viruses. Secondly, because I find this extremely interesting, and as I said, I won't get to it, there are cases that we now have followed where you constantly sample blood after one of these introductions, and you ask, how long does it take to find the virus, assuming? And we have two monkeys, one in which there's no viremia detected in blood for 4 weeks, another one for 6 weeks. So it looks like there's something going on where the virus is clearly in the body, percolating around at some extremely low level. But at some point, it takes off and it grows exponentially. And we have very nice data now, not only what I showed you before, but people who were sampled every 3 days when they became infected. And you can show that when you can measure the virus, it grows exponentially. So there's an early stochastic part, we think. Maybe it gets eliminated, and we've calculated things about that, because we'd like to know the difference between stochastic elimination and whether there's an early immune response. And we'd like to, so that's very important. But I thought you guys would rather see sequence things. So let me.
Is the idea that you have to wait to get to hitchhike a ride on an expanding T cell population?
Partly. Yeah, you may have to hitch a ride on a cell also to carry you from the epithelial layers, where you're just penetrating vaginal layer, rectal layers to get into a lymph node or into the bloodstream or other places. Another idea. But let me go through the first part, and then we can talk about the other stuff. So just I wanted to show you that if you take that toy model with three differential equations, let the T cells vary, and fit it to early infection data. So this is this crazy toy model, solid lines in here. It does a great job. What's interesting is there's no immune response on that. It's just constant clearance, constant loss of infected cells at these rates C and delta. As I said, here, these were patients who were identified late because they had symptoms. And when they have symptoms, it's when the viral loads are high. So we don't have much data here. We have some other blood bank data showing this thing does really go up exponentially. Also, that there are these windows where you don't see anything. It's called the eclipse phase, where viral levels are too low to detect.
Excuse me, the clearance of these viruses, so this is not immune response, is it? How does it work? Right?
So we yes and no. So clearance is they're phagocytic cells that just eat things. We've heard of the process phagocytosis. So there are cells in your body that will eat any kind of particle, and they just eat virus. What?
But even it's, I mean, any kind of
particle. Any kind of particles. You can put in.
Have to notice that it is not cell.
No, doesn't have to know it's not cell. You can put in sort of anything. You put in latex beads, and you show that they get eaten up. If you put antibody on these beads, then they get eaten up faster. So in the presence of antibody, the clearance does enhance, and there are experiments in mice with SIV, HIV showing that. So there is an immune component, but there's also just spontaneous clearance. But let me just, yeah.
So all these curves are sort of fit with your
that simple
four or five parameters, right?
Yep.
Which you have in the model. So every patient has different parameters for
That's right. So what was interesting, and this was noticed, we did this in 2000 when we had these patients, was noticed as early as 1996 by some other theorists publishing in Science that these types of models seem to work. They're called target cell limited. So the virus comes down because you're running out of cells to infect. No immune response. And so there's been a controversy to what extent does immune responses play a role in controlling the virus. And I'd like to show you in the next couple, couple slides, that from sequence data, we're now starting to see signals of a very strong immune response because the virus is evolving to change positions in which the immune system recognizes the virus. So we're starting to see the first indication that there really is an immune response going on. So let me give you the background. So one, very interesting, that was discovered just 2 years ago by taking patients at the first time that they could be identified and getting these viral isolates and then sequencing them. And they're doing sequencing by what was called single genome amplification. So you do limiting dilution, so every well, on average, you think has, you know, less, has one or fewer genomes in it by Poisson distribution. If you ever find in any well an ambiguous site, it possibly means that there were two things in there, so you throw it out, or there was a sequencing error. So in this study, 102 patients, early infection, were identified and sequenced. And this is one study where only the first about 2,500 bases were being done for the envelope gene. And 78 of them have this pattern. All of these sequences are totally identical. These colored things are single point mutations. So a number of viruses have one nucleotide change over 2,500 bases, and some of them have two. So we call this sort of a homogeneous infection by probably this virus with a little bit of diversification because we haven't gotten it at time zero. And these things obey a Poisson distribution, which is what this theoretical thing is here, looking at the Hamming distance between all pairs. And Hyun Lee, who's sitting here, is one who sort of done some of this early analysis. So whether one virus actually goes across or one infected cell, we have no idea. That's suggestive, but that's why we call this either a founder virus or a transmitted virus. So it could be multiple viruses get across, but only one grows to the level that we can detect. And there's now pyro sequencing 454 doing hundreds of thousands of sequences, also showing that it's extremely homogeneous in some of these patients. So it's not huge numbers of different viruses. So 78% are looked like that. Occasionally, the other 20 patients, we see two viruses. So here's another sequence here, this yellow, blue, yellow. Looks like it's a separate virus. Here's the major one. And again, just a little bit of point mutation. So there's something over here and something over here. And then there are some signals of recombination. So it looks like these guys with lots, clearly are very different than this. So there's two viruses. But then there are some subset that are missing the sequences up here. So it looks like it was a recombination of this with one of these that eliminates that. So in fact, when you do the Hamming distances, it looks like there's these two and something sitting in the middle. So that's the signal for recombination going on at this level. And clearly, there can be lots of recombination, but if the two RNAs are the same, you don't detect it.
So we have no alignment problems even.
Not in here, because everything's almost identical, so.
Oh.
but there are insertions and deletions that are taken out. So I should say, you know, if insertions and deletions are common, and you have to take that into consideration. So they're being taken out. There's also some other corrections that are being done. There's mechanisms of hypermutation by another enzyme, which has also been eliminated here. Subsequent to that study,
part of the genome are you looking at?
That was the envelope, the first 25. That was mainly envelope. Here's some sequences where they did full genome. So once that works, so here's the full, it's 9,300, I said 10,000, 93,000. So here's everything. And this is only three patients who are studied in great detail. And what's interesting, so there was this transmitted founder strain, which isn't being represented. So there's lots of sequences that are identical. And then you start seeing these point mutations. But the first study was only at one time point, so these are now being followed in time. So this is when they were first identified, 14 days later, 32, 102, et cetera. And what's interesting are these regions, quote, rakes of identity that are starting to show up. So something is being selected. So certain changes are showing up and persisting. So this was just throughout the genome. Here is another patient of the same sort. So various places So these reds are non-synonymous changes, but these, the red stuff, and they're in a coding gene. You're looking puzzled.
This is fantastic data, right? So how does numbers work out? So
how do the numbers work out?
They're being sequenced really rather frequently, right? Not too many days, and you see the frequency in changing.
Right? Okay, so I'll show you.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Next slide. Very rapid positive slope. Can you guys read this? So these are the three patients that were studied by the full genome. These boxes are the regions where we see these sort of rakes of identity. And we can now look at the frequencies as a function of time. So zero is infection. It's just the day the patient was found. And so you look at through all of these things, and there's nothing going on. So I mean, this is a fraction that have changed from the transmitted founder, the putative transmitted founder. At day 16, I guess nothing, in one place here, one particular gene, NEF, already 50% of the sequences have changed. At day 45, we now find lots of regions where the whole population is turned over. So you're no longer within these regions. So it's 100%, 58%, 7%, 93%, 100%, et cetera. Now, this isn't following one particular change. It's just saying within this region, this is, you can't read it, but it's 11 nucleotides up there, particularly in GAG, or up here it's 23, or no, 17. And what these regions correspond to are what we call putative epitopes, parts of the virus that the immune system they look at. So all of these boxes, if they're solid or black, they're confirmed what are called T cell epitopes. Those are regions that T cells actually can see and recognize on infected cells and lead to the death of cells that express these proteins. There's also ones in envelope. The blue ones are things that antibodies can recognize. Those are a little bit slower, but they will also change. And the dotted ones are only putative, so it's a little bit complicated. But the idea is that there are these responses by something called CD8 positive T cells. So CD4 cells are the ones that get infected. There's another subtype of cells called CD8 positive. They have different protein on their surface. And they act as what are called cytotoxic T lymphocytes, or killer cells that they can actually kill an infected cell. And since you guys are epidemiologists, I just wanted to show you one quick movie of a cytotoxic T cell. So that's a small, this guy is a T cell. This is a infected cell of some sort. If they're interacting, and that cell is going to punch holes in this membrane, and this cell is basically going to disintegrate. So these cells secrete granules across the interface between them to make the equivalent of a synapse, and it secretes molecules. One of them, for example, is called porphyrin. Makes pores in the membrane, and can directly kill cells. And that the way the T cell recognizes what to kill is it has a receptor on its surface, and that has to engage molecules on the surface of the cells that it's talking to. And those, what it looks at here are peptides, little pieces of amino acids that are typically 8 or 9 amino acids long that are sitting in the groove of a self-coated molecule called an MHC molecule. And so those are the regions on the virus genome that we were trying to look at, those 8 or 9 amino acid regions that can get recognized. And there's large databases now of CTL epitopes, and many of them, as I said, were confirmed in these patients just by taking their T cells and showing that they actually can recognize that and kill those particular peptides, the cells expressing those amino acids. Yes?
There are also data on T cell receptor sequences and how
it varies
also within a patient during the time.
We don't have the sequences of the T cell receptors here. So they can be identified by what are called MHC peptide tetramers, but they weren't done by sequencing. And there's also some functional assays to see whether they. So to try and get some idea of whether or not this selective pressure being generated, one can try and look at the fraction of viral sequences that mutate in these particular epitopes. And the idea is that if you have sort of strong CTL pressure, and then if these changes in the virus have low fitness costs, they don't prevent the virus from growing, that you should see sort of a rapid change in the virus called rapid escape. And that if you have a high fitness cost, it should go lower, and if you have weak pressure, it should go even lower. And that's, there's a number of theoretical biologists who have been doing this. This is one curve from a paper by Becca Asquith. So we've been doing exactly the same thing with this data. So we take our toy models, our viral dynamic models, this is sort of, and now look at two types of virus. One we'll call wild type, which is the transmitted founder, and quote mutant, which here means there's been some change from the transmitted founder, and we're not following in detail any particular change, because in these, turns out if one looks in detail at the sequences, if you look at these eight amino acid positions, there can be many different changes going on. But we don't have enough sequences to pick out any particular one to do any statistics on. They lead to infected cells, and here's our target cells. And then you can do a couple of things. One, we know that the clearance of virus is very fast, 30-minute half-life to or so. So you can do singular perturbations on these two equations, and you get just an algebraic constraint between virus and infected cells. So you can eliminate the virus in these equations by this. You can get just parameterize the target cells, as I told you before, just as a function of time, and come up with a viral replication rate, and boil these equations down with just those tricks into this form. So these are, after quasi-steady state, the infected cells of wild type and mutant. And what the idea is that they grow exponentially, that they are killed, delta here again is a death rate, and we're going to assume that the wild type virus is being killed by some sort of T cell attack. So it's the earlier models, we just said all death was constant. Here we want to pull out an extra term. And the idea is that if you mutate the region that the CTLs recognize, that this term goes away, that the CTL can no longer kill it. So you lose that. And maybe there's some cost to the virus, and so it will grow slightly smaller, and C is called the fitness cost. So if there's no cost, it replicates the same weight, and it's just normalized to one.
Right, but this you could have written down without the previous slide, right?
Right, and people have written that down without the previous slide. But I just want to show it also follows from models that we've actually validated, so they actually make sense. Okay. Most people just write these things down, and they get a little confused between whether they're talking about virus or cells. And so, but anyways, it's nice to do that. And then you can look at, so K over delta plus K sort of tells you the fraction of killing that we might attribute to CTL, the cytotoxic T cell. As I said before, all the models, and this, if you do this properly, we can draw more complicated models where this is actually parameterized by the number of CD8 cells. So again, this is probably is not constant, it's changing in time. These replication rates probably also are changing in time because of the numbers of T cells available. So don't think of these necessarily as constants. If you look at the proportion of mutants as a function of time, you find that they, solving these equations, it looks like this. But we call epsilon the escape rate, and it's really not necessarily constant because these parameters are time dependent. What it is the time average over them. And you then ask whether or not that equation works, sort of, you know, a logistic equation, and the answer is to a large extent it fits data on a lot of these different epitopes where we're just fitting the fractions now from that big slide before. So it's not a huge amount of data, but...
And the relative growth rates
that come out from here are surprisingly large compared to all previous literature in this field. And so these are the escape rates. They were averaging about 0.17 per day. The average death rate total from all other viral dynamic studies says that this rate is about one per day. I told you infected cells sort of die at a rate of about one per day. So on average, you know, it's something like 17%, 20%, and the highest ones are about 37, 40%. Prior estimates put this number down at 1 to 2%. So people were discounting, and that was because they didn't have very early samples. So it looks like this evolution is going on very, very rapidly.
And this is basically single point mutation
Yes, these are all single point mutations. So one question I have, you know, is, you know, this is done basically in the limit where we can study each of these regions independently, and it's sort of a trivial thing. Obviously, there's a lot of linkage going on. If you look at the sequences simultaneously, we're seeing escapes going on throughout the genome. We're starting to get 454 sequencing. We're having hundreds of thousands of sequences now. I'm in the domain of you guys. It's one of the reasons I'm here, to learn more about population stuff. I started having some conversations with Richard last week of trying to put in, explicitly putting in recombination and looking at allele frequencies and correlations between these sites. But I'm sure we can do more. I'd like to have that conversation with you and with other people. We've got lots of sequence data. Yun's also generating sequence data of this sort. So it's, as I said, it's really the first indication that we're seeing some strong pressure from the immune system, just because the virus is telling us that. Now, if you look at the viral loads, you don't see any signature. You don't really see that the viral levels are falling or going back up again. There's very, very small changes. So the net effect of these things in terms of the population is still small. The virus is clearly escaping, and then the idea is maybe it's going to be being attacked again by something else. Sergey?
Control, those fixations never happen on the parts of the viral genome which is not exposed.
Correct. I mean, there's other parts. So the non, if you look at the regions that we haven't identified as CTL, they're just undergoing very little evolution, and just point mutations are going on.
Which kind of tells you that there's no hitchhike in here, right?
Well, there's one or two of these things, as I said, that some of these regions have not been fully identified as being CTL epitopes. So there could be, in this gamish, some hitchhiking. We also think there's probably some reversion going on in some of these patients, that the transmitted founder is carrying an epitope that was recognized in the person who infected this person. And now in this new person, they have different MHCs, so their immune system looks at different things, and they may not be able to recognize things in the transmitted founder, and what we're seeing is them reverting back to a lower cost state. So that's the other thing that we think is going on here.
So it's basically the MHCs that mostly determine which short peptides. Segments of peptides can act as an epitope?
Yes. Because they have to bind to an MHC, and each individual has a unique set of MHCs. And for these patients, we know their MHCs, we know something about what they bind.
So with so much evolution going on in each patient, to what extent, you know, how come we even have, HIV virus genome?
Well, it's clear.
There are lots of subtypes. It takes pretty much the full alphabet to list them. And
right.
There's A, B, and C, and there's A, C, and
right, exactly.
That's the recombinant. But so the sort of global, you know, subtype genomes are just based on some very conserved part of the sequence?
Well, when you look at all of the sequences and try and do this, no, within a subtype. So if you look at, say, the envelope genes, which are variable, you can get something like 30% variation, 20-30% within a subtype. So some of them are quite variable. I'm not a phylogeneticist, but there's quite a lot of variation within even these subtypes.
For a subtype, we typically do envelope sequencing. Envelope is variable, so
right.
It has more information
than subtypes. But there's still enough identity between them that you can identify these different
not all these may transmit very well.
Well, that's what I was getting at. So is there a sense in which these mutants, you know, do well inside, adapt to particular host, but are not very good at infecting a random individual?
That can't be answered.
Let me tell you. Generation zero sequences, right? So
exactly.
Single clone
right.
Natives.
Right.
So.
Right. So this.
Compare.
Exactly. So they're being studied. So far, there's only one consistent pattern, signature pattern, has come out, and you know, there's still limited data sets, and it was in a non-coding leader sequence to the envelope protein. And that's been made now in SIV and studied in cell culture. That mutation seems to lead to, or that characteristic seems to lead to higher expression of envelope protein on the virions, making them more infectious. And when that goes away, which, if you look in viruses from people who have been infected for a long time, you don't see that there, so that's what distinguished them. So we've sort of played around a little bit. So the idea is that maybe the transmitted virus is specialized in rapid growth and infection. When it's in this exponential growth phase, that once it reaches the set point, it's being selected for other things. So this sort of notion from ecology, what they call RK selection. But there's only one position right now that's been found. There's been some other characteristics in some of the clades of charge distributions on the V3 loop. There's some distribution both in loop length and charge distributions. So again, people are looking at that. And as more data accumulates, which is what's very interesting, is the question is, are there certain characteristics? So for example, like your vaccine has to target rather than all possible sequences, maybe some subset that you want to look at. Or, and then there's this very, so let me just, maybe I think let's model this stuff. Oh, so other things that we're trying to do, get some help, is, we're saying, that was sort of crazy, just having one sort of rate of killing. So thinking of things where now you have, simultaneously have 10 CTO responses. So a wild type might be killed by 10. And then you have mutants of all different classes. So mutants can be attacked by 9 or 8 or 7 or different combinations. You have a sort of vector of all the possibilities. What we don't know very well is whether the attack by CTLs, if that's linear or not. We wrote this as a linear term, but you can also think of mechanisms where these are nonlinear interactions. We have some ancient data in vitro where, in fact, I was involved in analyzing these experiments where people took these cytotoxic T cells and target cells and centrifuged them together so they find each other. And then isolated what are called conjugates that had one killer cell, two killer cells, three killer cells on them, and then followed them in time. And you can show that compared to the ones that had one killer, the ones that had two were being killed roughly twice as fast or faster. And then three was not quite three times, but there was at least a monotonic relationship between the number of cells attacking a cell and how rapidly it was killed. So there's a little bit of justification for this. There's also evidence from that these CD8 cells might also act in different ways that I showed you. In addition to directly killing, they can also secrete molecules, which looks like that they can control the replication of the virus. They're called non-cytolytic effects. And in cell cultures, you can show that if you take the supernatant of these active, it's just the solution that they're being cultured in. And take that supernatant and put it on CD4 cells, the viral replication is downregulated. So there's some molecules. It's an embarrassment to the field that this has been known for over 10 years, and no one's been able to isolate these molecules yet. We call CD8 antiviral factor. And there's been a couple of reports that turned out not to be the right molecule. But there are experiments. We were involved in some in monkeys. You look at the kinetics of everything, and you can deplete them of CD8 cells by various means and ask, does the rate of death, as measured by all these viral dynamic things, change? And it doesn't change substantially. So again, there's some arguments as to why that might be non-cytolytic with the way we measure. But let me, so I've got 15 minutes. Okay, great. Let me tell you a little bit about stochastics, because this is one of the things I'm excited about. So I already told you this, that only about 1 in 100 to 1 in 1,000 sex acts leads to transmission. About 80% of the infections, at least for genital sex, looks like they come from a single viral genome. If you look at men who have sex with men, it's about 60%. This really, we think, depends on going through epithelial cell barriers. Intravenous drug users, it's lots of infection, lots of viruses get transmitted and found things. I want to show you this because I love this experiment where you inject low doses of this simian form of the virus into monkeys and look at what happens. But the net effect is it suggests, at least to me, that some of these early events are stochastic and not all encounters with virus lead to infection. And we'd like to know or quantify that to understand to what extent that these types of statistics rely on just stochastic events versus early immune responses, as Morris was saying, that we just don't know anything about. So we need to know a model to do the quantification. So let me, this is not great. Okay, so I'm going to show you some experiments now in monkeys. And the only thing to recognize on here is that there's going to be panels of monkeys. I'll show you in another slide. Hopefully it's going to come up better. Where in the initial inoculations, there were sort of 6 times 10 to the 7th viral RNAs or viruses put in, then tenfold lower, then tenfold lower. So experiments, just identical experiment. And what's going on the x-axis is that they're infected. If they don't show virus after 1 week, they're inoculated again and again, and it's sort of six weeks in a row. That's 6 times, and they're in a rectal. And then you wait a couple of weeks, and then you do it again. Wait a couple of weeks, make sure just waiting a week isn't long enough, and you do it again, and then some other things. So let me show you the real data. Hopefully that'll come up okay. So some colleagues did this experiment. So these are at the highest doses. These black dots are a week apart. The assay limit is 100. So being down here just means you can't detect anything. So this monkey was infected 1 week later. You can't detect anything. Was inoculated again the second week. You detect high levels of uremia. These viruses were sequenced at these time points, and this one doesn't have it. But there's, on average, the most frequent number of sequences is 1. There's a scattering of 2s and 3s, and, et cetera. But I have that data. So these colored points, this green point, they're sequenced. Here's the identical experiment, just in another macaque. And now the first week, you see nothing, inoculate again. The third week, nothing, inoculate again. The fourth, the fifth, the sixth. Then they wait, now you see something. And it's just with another virus. You drop it tenfold, and the variability gets even higher. This one, after the first week, you see something. This one, after the sixth. This one had 6 inoculations, and then 7, 8, and 9, they just waited longer to see if the virus comes up. Nothing. They went through another 6 inoculations. Still don't detect anything. Then they went back and did 6 inoculations now, but instead of doing it at this dose, they went back to a higher dose to see if there's something special. Nothing. And then after 18 inoculations, they injected this monkey in IV into the bloodstream directly and get something. So it wasn't that the monkey couldn't be infected. It just got whatever. And then you drop the dose tenfold more, and you can see you get all these times where, again, you can't get any infection in the monkey over 18 encounters with the virus, since these are 20 some odd weeks. It's a limit to what the experimentalists are willing to do, and then they do a IV and they get infected. So it's not that the monkeys are genetically incapable of being infected. And there's a lot of variability, as you can see. And we think the same thing happens in humans. They come in contact with the virus, and many times something's going on, especially at low doses. The other thing you can measure, which isn't done here, you also have data for, is what the dynamics look like. How long does it take when they come up? This is on weekly samples. You can do this more frequently, and you see the length of time it takes before the exponential growth phase, assuming they become infected, does vary with dose, which is what any of these models would suggest.
I don't know. Maybe I feel sorry for the monkeys, but what does one learn from this?
Well, there were a couple of things.
It's only costless, right? Or that it, I'm going to learn that it's not that.
I mean, what happens?
No, wait. So in terms of
bacterial infections of phage, would that experiment presumably can be done much greater volume?
Right. So this has nothing to do with phage, but so
well,
for Boris is
an idea, right?
Right. So for Boris, the reason the experiment was done was to confirm whether or not if you put in a quasi-species of virus, whether there's a particular founder virus. So the other half of this experiment, I don't know if I have this, was to see what was put into the monkeys in terms of sequences. And so everything being put in was being sequenced. This is the variability of what went into half of those monkeys. And then when the virus was detected and you sequenced, you could ask, do you always find this particular sequence? So that was the major point of it. But as part of that, we got all this variability. And the answer is there was no consistent pattern in terms of the viruses that grew out that one could pick out of this.
How did the virus inoculate in the monkeys?
How does it what?
Virus inoculated.
Inoculated. So this was just squirted indirectly. other than the ones that were put into the bloodstream when it didn't work. So it's trying to, and the same experiments are, same type of experiments are done with intravaginal experiments.
So how does this, how do these numbers of viruses compare with what you sort of estimated may happen during the same thing? I mean, I don't actually know what fluids and so on even contain viruses.
Right, so so semen does contain virus. I think this is high compared to what we would see in an ml of semen. I don't know what the total volumes are, but I can show you that later because we have, in fact, I'm analyzing right now data where they simultaneously have samples from both blood and semen. So I can tell you semen's lower concentration than blood, but I don't remember the exact numbers, at least in the patients that we have. But I can tell you that.
Speaking,
but roughly, these are not bad. This is probably a little bit more than, but again, it depends on the volume of ejaculate too, since. So anyway, we're trying to make stochastic models to see what's going on, and this is the very trivial stuff again. So, you know, we base it on this cartoon, since this cartoon works well, and all we've done is made that into a set of state transitions and do a master equation approach. So this is really what that dynamic model is: virus plus T cells gives infected cells produce virus. Infected cells die and virus is cleared. The analysis we've done so far is we assume T was constant to make this into a linear process. The idea when we did this is if we're looking at the very earliest events, there's not very much T cell depletion going on. I would like to go back and do this if somebody helped me do the nonlinear problem, and that's because I think space is very important and that this virus is penetrating epithelial layers and getting into regions where, in fact, you may be depleting T cells in a spot that the virus is actually getting. So this is going to be important to do. We've not done that. So we've looked at this. And what's interesting is in the stochastic model, the way virus is produced makes a difference. So in ODE models, we couldn't tell the difference between virus being produced as a continuous process in time. If a virus, you can say, just buds off and you produce it at some constant rate or even a time-dependent rate, versus the equivalent of a lytic infection where the virus comes out, quote, in a burst. So here, this is sort of continuous virus production. So what we're going to assume is that infected cells just make virus at some rate per unit time. The alternative model, which I'll show you in a couple of slides, is that it comes out in the burst and the cell dies. So these two processes collapse into one. And what happens is an infected cell gives rise to, say, N virus particles, and you lose the infected cell. So instead of having four reactions, you'd have three. And so the stochastic model is therefore different, while the ODE models are identical in the mean field. And so you just do this as a set of, you know, keep track of these things as integers. So this is just the integer number of viruses and the integer number of infected cells. And these infection processes, you lose a virus and you gain an infected cell. This is virus clearance, you lose a virus. This is virus production, you gain a virus. And this is death of infected cells. And you sort of can parameterize those. So you can write down a master equation, you can do Gillespie simulations. And what we were interested in is sort of what Boris wanted to know, can you clear? So you can calculate, quote, the probability of extinction, which means the probability if you start in some particular state with a certain number of infected cells and viruses, clearing both of them, reaching the origin. And it's pretty simple to calculate this, and that's assuming that you make the assumptions that the clearance of each virus particle in each infected cell is independent. And so with these being the rates of going extinct, if you start with one virus, and this is with one infected cell, and this is the actual state that you're in, you can plug that into something, get a recursion, starting at that state, moving to some new state, and you actually then put down all these transitions where the probability of moving is these various reactions that I showed you, and that boils down to a recursion relation, starting originally and making one step, and that gives rise to some algebraic equation. So it's all very simple mathematics. And you find, sort of as in the case of epidemiology, that there's one important parameter that defines transitions, which in epidemiology is called basic reproductive number, or basic reproductive ratio, R0, which there corresponds to, if you take one infected person and put them into a population of susceptibles, how many people do they infect? Here we do the same thing. We say if you take one infected cell and it, on over its lifespan, produces N virus particles, and then ask what's the number of cells they infect, we just multiply it by the probability that a virus infects a cell rather than getting cleared. So K times T is the rate of infection, C is the rate of clearance. That ratio is the average fraction of viruses that infect. So that gives you the basic, this sort of the equivalent of the basic reproductive number. And you can show if that number is less than one, that the process will go extinct with probability one, and that if it's greater than one, that there's a finite chance of it going extinct, but it's and it depends on these parameters. So it's all very straightforward. You can do the same thing, as I said, for burst. So there's only three reactions. That gives you something a little bit more complicated that you can't solve explicitly. You can solve these things to get dynamics. And what's sort of interesting is so this is the number of infected cells, and this is the number of viruses under this, quote, continuous production model. And these are just sample paths of things that lead to infection. And these down here are just some other simulations, just by chance, that go extinct. And what we always find, at least for the ones that go extinct, is there's very few cells that become infected. So this hit a maximum of four, and the number of virus particles floating around is relatively limited. Also, I should say, in this simulation, we're assuming every virus particle is infectious. So all virus particles are equivalent. That is not true. So in reality, if one takes virus out of a chronically infected person, you find maybe 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 10,000 viruses seem to be capable of generating infection in cell culture. Yes?
But T cells also divide, right?
Yes.
So if you infect a T cell, you might... How does it happen? Does it happen in a random way, or is there some clusters, or is it some kind of factories, or is it common divide, or
clusters? That's hard. So T cells divide. Spatially, they do divide in particular locations, in places like lymph nodes.
That's where there's a lot of... For example, to infect each other.
Yes,
also,
yes. So the spatial things. Rita Sorensen here has studied some spatial aspects of this thing. Yes. So anyway, so this is all, let me not dwell on this because it's getting late. But the idea is that what we can see, which is consistent with that, if you look at various sample paths, that there's something that goes on. And then at least when you get infection, they take off, and it does look exponential. It goes into this exponential growth phase. What doesn't match the data with this simple model is the time it takes to go into this exponential phase. So in this simple model, things take off in a day or two. I told you we have a monkey that it took 6 weeks till we could detect virus. Another one that took 4 weeks, and a lot of experiments where it's more like 7 to 11 days is very, very common.
You kept reinfecting?
Yes, you kept reinfecting the monkey, right?
So, no. This is other cases, single infection. Other experiments. Other experiments. Just one introduction. One introduction at low doses. Let me jump. So what we think, at least what I think, and I'll just end here. So these are with these typical parameter values. When we look at the exponential growth phase, this basic reproductive number estimated during patients in exponential growth is of order 8 to 10. There's one even smaller. And that gives you, from this type of theory, a very high probability of infection. And this is assuming that each cell produces 10 infectious viruses. It's got to be more than R0. R0, we think, is, as I said, of order 10. So this is sort of a minimal estimate. So almost everything gets infected here, not like in the data where it's 1 in 1,000, and it takes a lot longer. The way one can make things look closer to the data with this model, and this is not necessarily the right model, is by making R0 get very, very close to 1. So don't forget, the extinction occurs as a phase transition at 1, and as you approach it, then the time for the from these simulations for things to take off can get very, very large.
What if you add the mutants in this model?
Well, don't forget, early on, you're not going to have very much replication. So what we find is you go into the exponential growth phase, by the time you've got sort of a dozen cells infected or so. So there's not much time for mutation to go on. So we're looking at very, very early events.
Isn't it plausible that somehow, you know, the virus gets in and it's and the virus particles circulate, and then there is only maybe a small number of places where they can go in and actually start expanding. Yeah. And the question is, do you hit one of those places?
Right. So I think that's exactly what I think may be going on. So if it goes in. We can say where there aren't very many T cells, and the virus grows best in what we call activated T cells, cells that are actively dividing, have good metabolic resources for the virus to exploit. But if you go into a place where there's not very many T cells, because there's no inflammation, nothing much is happening, maybe in fact that you are in this limit where R0 is maybe even less than 1, because there's no targets there. Or it's very close to 1, so it may take a long time. And that for those cases in which you start seeing expansion, then as the virus, you've got this positive feedback going on. Once the virus starts growing a bit, then things in the immune system see it, secreting cytokines and signals that there's an infection, which leads to infiltration of more T cells and more activation, and so more targets become available. The other thing is,
the T cell doesn't die, right?
So no, it doesn't die.
It keeps releasing.
No, it lives for about a day.
For about a day.
It's not long lived. The virus
kills. Are there known cases where the cell could live actually? The average is about a day, but maybe some T cells live for. For months.
So if you're absolutely right, so there are, as I said, there are these other cells that seem to be able to live much longer and produce virus, a few percent. The other thing that we know happens, at least when the infection formally gets established, is that there's movement of the virus and infected cells out of the, say, the genital tract, if it's in sexual transmission. So the virus gets out into lymph nodes, into the circulation. So other things that give rise to these long times are, these transport processes. So we're now working on sort of two compartment models where we say, there's a site where the virus first gets into. And then there's some rate of either transport, which you can do by diffusion. There's transport that one can just do as a stochastic process. So have sort of two compartments with stochastic transitions between them to allow them to get into the other compartments. And if these from getting out of the vaginal tract is rare, then it's going to take a long time to see anything in the circulation. Why are all these things important? Well, a couple of things. One is, and then I'm going to stop on this. If this region we don't see anything is typically long, if it really is weeks, it means that, the sort of a large, experimentalists like to call it a window of opportunity, because that's when you can try and stop this infection. So if we can intervene, if we can identify people, or if we think they have them, say, with antiretroviral drugs, which is actually being tried now, it's called post-exposure prophylaxis. So if someone has risk effects, and come in and say, is there a window of time in which you can experimentally just give drug and shut things off, which it looks like you can, or they're not. You can do other interventions during that period. I'm a little worried about some of the other strategies that lead to immune activation, because immune activation tends to cause T cells to come into these areas, which might actually give you targets and push R0 above. So it means that in terms of our vaccination strategies, that by getting higher levels of T cells in these regions, if they're not high enough really to give you enough protection, you might be making things worse. And I think it's interesting to try and work out what those boundaries are. Again, it's something that's difficult. The last thing in terms of transport, we're working with a guy named Tom Hope at Northwestern who does fluorescently labeled viruses, GFP. Looks at their penetration through the mucosa, so you can get pieces of vaginal tissue and uterine tissue from undergoing hysterectomies. You can bathe them in virus. You can watch the viral transport, how far it can penetrate, what the speed is. One can track the particles to look at their motion. It turns out it's greatly impeded by mucus. It's greatly impeded by antibodies. And get some idea quantitatively of what I'm talking about is this transfer. We don't have to just do a trivial model, a toy model. I think there's some serious work that could be done there to try and look at this. So I think it's sort of a lot of opportunities in this sort of acute infection business as well. I'll stop there, say the stochastics is going to come out in these very trivial models with plus computational biology. It's impressed with a done with guy at Los Alamos, John Pearson, and a applied mathematician at BU, Paul Krivitsky, who works on these stochastic models. All the early stuff I told you about was done with David Ho, who's our major experimental collaborator in all the therapy business. And the sequence stuff, as I said, was done with Hayden here and some other people in Los Alamos. So thank you, and I apologize for going over by 5 minutes.
So, regarding this strong evolution, or quite vivid evolution that you detected, how is it explainable that these viral levels are so constant? Shouldn't somehow this strong selection more business here somehow reflected in concentration levels of viruses?
Right, so as I said, that's one thing that's been unusual about this. When we detect these escapes by viral evolution, the sequences are changing. We don't see large changes in viral level. That's been, and part of it is sampling. I mean, if you look at the time between those samples, even the early ones, you're still 2-3 weeks. And what may very well be happening is the virus is escaping one response and starting to grow, and then there's just other T cell responses that then come in during that period and start controlling it. So there's a huge diversity of T cells in each of us that can recognize large numbers of these epitopes. And still, we probably can recognize something like somewhere between 10 to the 5th and 10 to the 8th epitopes at a given time. So it may very well be that there's just other responses that come in. Also, the virus is simultaneously being recognized at all these different places. So it's also not clear if you release the escape but on one of 10 places that are being recognized, that that's going to give rise to a large change. And that was what's very surprising to me of this, that we actually see that the virus is evolving to do that. And whether it's, and I really quite haven't understood how it's doing it simultaneously at so many places. So you guys have to help me with the population genetics. Because if I'm being attacked by 9 other things and I've just lost the ability to be attacked by one, it would seem to me to be such a small effect that I shouldn't see such rapid evolution. So that's a puzzle.
Is it known that the immune system has some mechanisms to keep total T cell count at some very fixed level?
Yes. So I mean, in healthy individuals, there definitely is. There are homeostatic mechanisms that maintain T cell counts. Here, the virus is depleting it. It looks like the body is trying to restore it, but it isn't capable of doing that.
After
a long period of time. And in fact, the equivalent of ecological niches, the places where T cells tend to grow and hang out, get destroyed, so their architecture and lymphoid tissue gets destroyed. So even when we bring virus down by drugs, we know there's no longer massive killing, T cells don't come back rapidly. It's a very long process to restore the places where they grow.
Is it possible then that the total viral level doesn't change much because it's tightly coupled to the total T cell level? Yeah. And that's basically just maintained by the body by some homeostatic mechanism. Yeah. So that actually maybe the turnover of T cells is actually changing. Mm-hmm. It's becoming faster and faster as this virus is becoming better and better.
No, there is some evidence
that you just say that the total number is limited by target cells, right, by T cells, and the difference in any case is presumably in the rate of clearing, right, by while the viruses are free.
Right? And that's that and
saying that if you're clearing, the mutant. Less rapidly.
Right? No. So there's both. There's the clearance of the free virus, which would be antibody dependent,
right.
And then there's the clearance of the infected cells, which is what the CTLs are doing. They're actually killing the infected cells. So the question is, how much faster are infected cells killed when there's T cell presence versus the virus killing them?
Right.
And again, if they're killed, you know, a few hours earlier, what does that impact? And one of the questions which we've not resolved, and I've been trying to get our experimental collaborators to do this, is to understand the kinetics of virus production. And like I said, in these models, we do things like constant virus production, but that's obviously wrong. If the virus, for example, is being produced almost like bacteriophage, say exponentially, so then keeping the cell alive an extra 2 or 3 hours might generate an enormous difference in the amount of virus being produced.
But in bacteria, it's only because bacteria divide.
Pardon me?
In bacteria, it's only because bacteria keep dividing. Mm-hmm. If you said that T cells only divide in some special places, then presumably most of the T cells would not divide at any given time.
Well, it's complicated. So in a healthy individual, maybe about 1% of your T cells are dividing. We can detect. In HIV-infected patients, as the T cells get depleted, the fraction of cells that are dividing goes way up. So they're trying to maintain their numbers, and then they do that by these homeostatic mechanisms. So we've had patients with very low CD4 counts where maybe 60% of the cells look like they're in division, at least in blood. There's this inverse correlation. As the CD4 count goes down, the fraction of cells in division goes up. It's trying to maintain numbers and they're being infected, unfortunately, very effectively.
So is that what is happening when the CD4 cell starts going down?
Yes.
Towards the end? Okay.
Yes. So as they go down, the fraction that are replicating goes up. That's not enough
to... That's when the virus takes off.
No, it's actually occurring throughout this whole phase. It's very exactly what happens at the end when the virus takes off in that cartoon.
Yep.
It's not well understood, and it doesn't always happen, so that's sort of the textbook picture. I have some ideas, but it's very difficult to understand because you've depleted a lot of T cells also. And so some people think the virus finds another target. I think that these CD8 cells are very important, and we're losing CD8 control. CD8 cells start going down at that time too.
How do this cartoon was shown for no treatment?
Right.
So now in the presence of these very good treatments.
So what's happening, at least in the cartoon versions of these models, is you're just tuning down the parameters, so the rate of infection, the rate of virus production.
But at some point, we'll still die, even though we have these combination drugs, where the virus can...
Will the person die?
The person dies eventually, right? Don't we know?
We don't know. Eventually, yes, we do know. Yes, we do know. Eventually, a person will die. I can tell you that there are people now, you know, who've been on therapy for 15 years, and are still here. So we do have a subpopulation of people who've been treated for very long periods of time. There are other effects of treatment, though. They cause changes in lipid metabolism. You get high cholesterol, so now worried about you dying of heart disease. There's other infections in these populations. They tend to be a lot of intravenous drug users, or people do high-risk sex. So many of them are dying from hepatitis C infection. They're getting co-infected by things that we can't treat very well. So it's complicated. Let me just say that. Okay, well, anyway, I'm here, so if anybody's interested in this stuff, I'd love to talk to you about it.